Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello. How's Chutney, your imaginary dog?
Well, you know, it's funny you should say this because I did a Yorkshire Business Forum Zoom call with lots of businesses in Yorkshire a couple of days ago, and the very nice hosts asked me about Chutney. The news of Chutney is spreading.
I thought you were going to tell us that Chutney interrupted the Zoom call. You know, you keep seeing this footage of people with their pets coming in when they're
doing true.
Video conferencing.
Well, there was a great one actually the other day of a weatherman in somewhere in America.
I saw it, yeah,
and
yeah.
His dog completely disrupted it.
Yeah.
No, Chutney's doing okay. I mean, he's being good-ish. I mean, he's taking some time with the training and clearly the walking of him is kind of quite a business, but, you know.
Has everybody got clearly defined roles for looking after Chutney in the family?
I think so. I think obviously the lion's share is falling on the parents, but, you know, the children just like to sort of, you know, cuddle him and sort of have a nice time and, you know, feed him dog biscuits.
I tried to find you one of those novelty imaginary dog leads.
I haven't bought it, but I did find one, yeah. Yeah, I thought it might be taking it a bit too far, actually.
Yeah.
Walking around with a lead with no dog.
Yes, I mean, I don't know that there are that many paparazzi on the streets at the moment.
No, that's true.
Even so, there are people with camera phones. You don't want that, do you?
I think on balance, you don't. You don't really. It might seem a bit peculiar. How's your week been? You're in the kind of birthday sandwich, aren't you? Because yours was last week, and you know we obviously had a big celebration for that. And Sarah's is now sort of tomorrow. Actually, we're recording on Friday.
Yes. So I'm still sort of figuring out what to do.
You're still figuring it out.
Well, I thought I could have her favourite bagels delivered, but then. I double checked and they don't deliver to my postcode. So I've got a few ideas, but I've got her a very good present. I can tell you what it is.
Because, yeah, go on.
She's not here, obviously. I've got her a pressure washer.
What's that?
You know, one of those hoses for cleaning off the paving slabs in the back garden.
Right.
You don't think this is a good birthday present?
I mean, that's a very romantic present.
She is obsessed. A couple of summers ago, she borrowed one from one of our neighbours and she became so obsessed about using it that she was out till midnight pressure washing the backyard.
Do you get to turn the sort of front of it so it goes psh?
Exactly, yeah.
It's a hose, really, isn't it?
It is a hose, but it's a really powerful hose. Well, I'll let you know how...
A hose by any other name.
I'll let you know how it goes down on next week's episode.
Look, I think it's good. I think I'm definitely not present shaming you. I think it's I'm obviously not in a position to do that. No, I think it's I think it's good. I mean, we're actually already starting to wonder what situation is going to be when Daniel has his birthday at the beginning of June. But I think we're sort of a bit early to be thinking about that.
Well, let's talk about this week's episode, and there's some really positive news, I think.
Yes, let's talk about this week's episode. We're talking about the action taken on homelessness in the last month or so. At the end of March, the government asked English councils to provide housing for all rough sleepers during the lockdown to allow them to socially distance. And thousands of rough sleepers have been housed in empty hotels, B&Bs and student accommodation. The government says that 90% of those sleeping rough before social distancing have been helped into temporary housing. And there's some discussion about the exact figures, but there's definitely been a massive change. It's important to say that at the same time, conditions have got worse for some of those left on the streets, and the economic crisis risks leading to a rise in homelessness. But this rapid action suggests we are actually able to end some of our biggest social problems when there is a political will to do so. And we're going to be talking to Matt Downey from Crisis and Maggie Brunges from Homeless Network Scotland about what the lessons of this are and how we build on it to prevent a return to rough sleeping coming out of the crisis. And then we'll be asking geographer Danny Dorling what this shows more broadly about our ability to tackle injustice.
That all sounds great, and we should do our reasons to be cheerful. What's yours?
I think I've got two, really.
You've had a good week.
I mean, just in the sort of animal kingdom theme, I was quite struck by the Japanese eels. Do you know about this?
Are these real eels or imaginary eels?
No, these ones are actually real eels. Okay. The campaign for real eels. These are the eels in Japan that, because in an aquarium, that because the that there have been no visitors, obviously, in the last 6 weeks or so, they've become rather kind of discombobulated, and now they've become very shy. And so whenever the keepers pass by, they disappear. So people are being asked. They've now set up 5 iPads around the eelery, and they're asking people to sort of FaceTime with the eels.
Wow.
Maybe that's quite a good birthday present for Sarah. She could FaceTime with an eel.
Well, she's really freaked out by eels. If we ever go to an aquarium, she will stand looking at them and sort of shrieking.
Well, let's find out what the eels think about Sarah.
Drawn. Yes. Okay, there we go.
It might be an extra present. And then the other one is sort of in the box set vein. You know, we're all, you know, wanting stuff we can watch. And it's quite nice when you get into something that you know you've got a massive number of series to go. So we've started to get into Parks and Recreation.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
With Amy Poehler. And the thing I like about Parks and Recreation are it's quite funny. It doesn't involve sort of, you know, death or destruction. It's quite short. So it's like 20 minutes or so an episode. And it's quite, I know you've never quite got into it, but I'm recommending it.
Well, they've just done a reunion episode as well, I believe. I mean, you're a long way off.
I didn't even know it had ended.
Yeah, I think it ended 5 years ago.
Oh, gosh.
And they've just done a reunion in the form of a Zoom meeting, which I was reading about this morning. So, you know, you might be watching that come 2024 or something.
I mean, sometimes it can be, I said to Justine, why don't we skip to Series A? And that was a kind of very, very heretical concept. She just did not think that was the right thing to do.
I think that's why would you do that?
Just when you see the ending. get up to speed. Anyway, what's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is Sirius Radio, which is American satellite radio, which you can't get over here.
On which you generally broadcast about the Beatles.
I do. The Beatles have their own channel over there, and I do a show for them. But they are streaming for free during the lockdown until, I think, the end of May. And you can listen online here in the UK. And part of that means you can listen to Howard Stern's interviews. Now, Howard Stern has this reputation as a shock jock and for doing some, you know, certainly the stuff he was doing in the 80s and 90s by today's standards is highly questionable, to say the least. But his interviews that he's been doing these past few years are the best interviews you will hear with anybody anywhere. He is so adept. I mean, he's a man who spends 5 days a week in therapy, and it shows in his interviews. But he will do these incredible hour, sometimes 2 hour long conversations with people like Hillary Clinton, Jerry Seinfeld, David Letterman, Paul McCartney, whoever. And they are incredible. If you sort of put aside everything you think you know about him and just listen to him as an interviewer, they're just magnificent.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
To discuss
where we are now with homelessness during this crisis and what lessons it has for the future. I'm glad to say that we are joined by Matt Downey, who's Director of Policy and External Affairs at Crisis, and Maggie Brunges, who is Chief Executive of Homeless Network Scotland. Thank you so much for joining us. Matt, we spoke to you a couple of years ago about ending homelessness in the UK and the idea of housing first. We've seen major steps taken in the last few weeks on rough sleeping. Tell us, just to begin with, what has happened and how it's been done.
Yeah, so something absolutely extraordinary unfolded just over a month ago, where in response to the pandemic, someone quite extraordinary turned up back in Whitehall called Louise Casey, who I know you will have worked with before, Ed, who has a track record in reducing rough sleeping, but also working on a series of other issues. And an email was sent out to all local councils in England on a Wednesday evening, seemingly innocuously. And what it said was, we would like you to end rough sleeping by the weekend. And lo and behold, thousands of people were brought from the streets and out of night shelters and put into hotels, put into student accommodation, put into flats, self-contained units. And not everyone that needed somewhere safe to stay got somewhere safe to stay, but we're now at a stage where over 5,000 people have been taken off the streets and out of night shelters in England. And the vast majority of rough sleeping was ended almost overnight. So the government's target, which it had, which was to end rough sleeping in 5 years, was reduced to 2 days. And we saw that not only was it absolutely possible, but it was possible really quickly. So really, the game is up on any kind of cynicism, that particularly in terms of rough sleeping, that it can't be ended. And it's not complete. Yes, there are still some people on the streets and some people, haven't necessarily flourished in that hotel situation, but the vast majority of people are now safe from the virus, but also safe from the everyday dangers of rough sleeping and homelessness.
It's a 90% reduction, is it, Matt?
Well, the government have claimed a 90% reduction. It's not quite that. That sort of breaks down. It's 90% of people that have had an offer about a month ago, were given an alternative they could take up. It's not 90% of everyone. And of course, the problem is that there are still people becoming homeless. So there are more people going onto the street all the time. But, certainly in England, we saw something extraordinary happen. And, Maggie will talk about Scotland. But in Wales, I would say it's been even better. So,
how much has it cost in England?
Well, in England, there's only been £3.2 million that's been given to councils to do this. You'll know there's over 300 local councils in England. In Wales, £10 million was given to 22 local councils. And it's even better in terms of the results in Wales. We're told it's just single figures of people out sleeping rough now in Cardiff and other towns and cities, which is absolutely extraordinary. And it's testament, I suppose, to the idea that when government is assertive, when it says what it wants, when it funds what it wants, and when it puts sort of principle into action, extraordinary things really can happen.
Amen to that. Maggie, homeless policy is devolved in Scotland. Tell us about the situation there.
Yeah, and thanks. And that's a very important starting point, actually, because it goes some way to explaining, I think, the different levels of rough sleeping across the UK. So not least, of course, Scotland's a smaller country, so the starting point is different. And the fact that housing policy is devolved means that people across the UK have a different set of rights if they become homeless. And in Scotland, almost everybody has a right to at least temporary accommodation, and most people have a right to settled accommodation. So, as I say, it means that even proportionately, the starting point of rough sleeping in Scotland is lower. What we could also say, and I think what we recognise is exactly what Matt just described, is this remarkable urgency around the situation. The fact that we have partners across the country in all our different roles, from local and national government to third sector providers to real local grassroots voluntary groups, all on the same page, and everybody behaving well, because everybody sees it as an opportunity to do something incredibly important. So we are definitely recognising that urgency as well. So I think similar, and I think across the UK, the approach has been very similar. And it seems as though it's not the same approach that's happening in other parts of Europe and beyond. So I think we can take quite a lot to be proud of this. But moving people that were sleeping rough into hotel accommodation, and in Edinburgh particularly using short-term lets, so typically what were Airbnbs, to get almost all people that were sleeping rough into this temporary kind of accommodation. So we think in Glasgow now, less than 5 people are still sleeping rough. Edinburgh, less than 10.
Amazing. Amazing. As somebody who works in this area and has worked in it for some time, Maggie, has it sort of surprised you?
I think exactly the point that Matt made is one that I would support, is that I think hypothetically we always knew it was possible. I think we were able to draw on experiences in other parts of the world, particularly if you look at what's happening in Finland and kind of parts of North America, who, when they really put their mind to it and when they really provide a determined policy environment and make sure that that's backed up with funding, that they do see these differences, these radical differences in terms of the scale, nature and causes of rough sleeping. So I think, you know, Matt, you would probably express the same. I think when we look at it through a UK lens, we always knew it was possible, hypothetically, but to see it done so quickly, at least the rough sleeping sharp end of it, has been phenomenal.
And what do we know about the impact so far on the people who are now in accommodation?
A couple of stories on that, Jeff. I think the first one that really struck me was a guy in his 40s in the Midlands who was put into a hotel, and he had been sleeping rough for a number of years, and we were in touch with him. And the first thing we noticed was he was saying to us that he wouldn't sleep on the bed, that he would sleep on the floor. And that he himself was describing how he didn't feel like he was worthy of what had been given to him. And there was a real sense of kind of, you know, that his own personal kind of confidence and sense of dignity had been so damaged by his time on the street that he couldn't quite believe what was happening to him. And that, you know, I mean, luckily we've been supporting him for a number of weeks, and I hope he's feeling a lot more positive. Another story was somebody in the Northwest, a young woman who had been on the streets for, I think, about a year, and has a very serious addiction issue. And she has been in a, not just a hotel now, but an apartment hotel. So she has her own kind of cooking facilities and bathroom and all the rest of it. And she's told us she's been clean for the 30 plus days that she's been in there. And this is the moment that she's been waiting for to start rebuilding her life. You know, this is... You know, going back to what we talked about last time in terms of housing first, the ability for people to feel like they're safe and confident in their own physical space really can unlock, you know, the future for people, and not just recovering from their homelessness, but unlocking what it is that they want to achieve in their lives.
Are people able to address the other issues that they might be dealing with now that housing is something that is sorted out for them for the time being? Are you finding that people are able to address their other issues?
Well, I mean, this is hard because obviously the social distancing element of this is, you know, means that the support staff that we have, and I'm sure Maggie has, work, you know, you can't physically get to people. There's a lot of online work going on to get people, you know, the practical assistance to get onto the universal credit or get kind of drug and alcohol treatment or whatever it might be. But of course, yes, it's so much easier. I mean, all of us are much more able to address our problems if we've got somewhere safe to live. It's just a basic human fact that seems to have escaped kind of policy making on homelessness for a long time. I think, you know, it's very good, obviously, that people are safe in hotel spaces, but it isn't the answer. The answer is a home of their own. And that's why really now is the chance, particularly in England, to supercharge Housing First and see it completely spread across the country. So we see that as the answer.
Maggie, have you seen people being able to have access to other services to deal with, for example, mental health or addiction issues? Or is that tricky at this time?
I think it's tricky for reasons that we all understand in terms of some of the rules that are in place that are just kind of prohibiting, you know, kind of access to normal services. But what it's definitely doing on a more positive note is it's definitely providing that breather that moment to just collect your thoughts, you know, to just take this, as Matt describes, take this as an opportunity to think through, right, after this, what's next for me, you know.
And it is, you know, I don't want to detract from it. It's an incredible thing. Just the numbers that we started with are amazing. But I wondered if we could talk a little bit about the sort of ongoing problems for those people who are still on the streets, but also the risk. Matt, you touched on this, the risk of homelessness for people during and because of the crisis.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it would be really remiss not to point out that there are people still on the streets, and in many ways it's much worse than normal times, and you know, Lord knows it's bad enough in normal times, but you know, our services are still open, and we're seeing people who haven't eaten for days because, you know, what they might normally rely on in terms of, you know, shops being open, food banks being open, public donations, you know, soup runs even, none of them are there. And, you know, this is sort of, for people still on the streets, this is a humanitarian situation. And, you know, I think it's extremely serious. And we you know, continue to push the government to make sure they're not complacent or in any way sort of self-congratulatory about this, because it's until it's done, it's not done. And even, you know, even if we're talking 5 or 10 people in, as Maggie has said, in Glasgow and Edinburgh, that's still too many. And yes, there are new forces leading people into homelessness. So we were talking to people in central London the other day who were almost kind of sort of, you know, shell-shocked by homelessness appearing so quickly in their lives, and particularly people that have come out of the hospitality and catering industry, which absolutely depended on this. Some people whose accommodation went with their job in the hospitality industry, that kind of thing. And so, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people who were just on the edge of homelessness. And if you imagine, if you were sofa surfing, kind of, you know, getting friends and family or just people you know to give you a favour, they're less likely to do that when they've got their own social distancing and isolation arrangements to deal with. So, yeah, it's very serious for those people who still are on the streets.
It's that feeling, isn't it, that we all have that experience of, at the moment of, you know, all these systems that we take for granted round about us kind of grinding to a halt. I mean, I guess one of the things for people that are sleeping rough and going through some of the toughest times of their life is that that's their normality. It was kind of always that way. And what they're going through at the moment was what they were kind of going through before. And I guess the imperative for us that care about kind of trying to make this easier for people is about trying to make sure that that's not the normal that they return to. That idea of that kind of lack of certainty, the lack of security, all that contradictory advice that's out there, not getting enough advice, feeling, you know, people not being shown up, services not speaking to each other. I mean, that's stuff that we're all going through at the moment, and as I say, what people have been going through for most of their lives, really. So for us, how can we ensure that we can collect our thinking and action on the ground to make sure that we can, you know, create a better response for people after this?
I guess the sort of absolute million-dollar question now is, as well as the issues you've raised about those who have entered into crisis, how do we ensure we don't go back to where we were on rough sleeping? And I'm sure that's a lot in your mind, because, you know, we can't just, you know, not solve it, but we can't go so far to addressing it as we have during this crisis, only to slip back to where we were. And just to be interesting, Maggie, why don't you start just to give your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a window. And it's not as long a window as we would like, but it's one that we've not had before. It's almost a bit of a pause to enable people to get their act together in all our different roles across local and national government, third sector providers, housing associations and others, to really plan now for what's going to come up ahead in the next kind of few weeks. There's a view, I think, quite widely shared that the tourism sector is no doubt going to be affected for a period post-COVID. So what that means for hundreds of people in hotels is that, you know, the risk of people being turfed out overnight is probably not going to happen. There's probably going to be an amount of time, small amount of time, to enable some of those step down services to happen. But there's a bigger conversation, isn't there, around about that, that people need to have. And I think in Scotland it's a conversation that's definitely started. So it's about how can we get councils and housing associations to make homes available for Scottish Government, of course, in the longer term. How do we ensure that we build more social housing? But in the short term, how do we just get local housing systems moving? And housing systems, including the temporary housing systems that many people are in. So not including the people that we're talking about that have taken up hotel and short-term let accommodation as a result of the crisis. In Scotland, there's already 11,000 people sitting in temporary accommodation waiting to move through the system into permanent accommodation. So the actions that we need to take, some of them need to be short-term and now, and it's about protecting with urgency people that are in hotels and short-term lets, but also the next steps, which is about looking at the system and trying to create as many housing options and as many opportunities for people to enable that whole system to move forward. So there are a number of low cost, also medium and high cost incentives and actions that can be taken to just now to enable in the next few weeks to ease forward as quickly as possible.
Excellent, Matt.
Yeah, I suppose the what this has shown is that when you take off all of the kind of arbitrary barriers that were in place for people to get into housing or to stay in housing, something amazing can happen. And you know, when the sort of legendary email went out from Louise Casey asking to get everyone off the streets, it was clear it was everyone. It wasn't dependent on your immigration status. It wasn't dependent on your kind of, you know, whether you're considered by as a priority by your local council or whether you're seen to have caused your own homelessness. All of those things overnight would disappeared. And of course, you know, what that shows is that when we decide to help everyone, regardless of whether we sort of badge some people as deserving or undeserving, we can do extraordinary things. And that principle must be continued. That's the way forward. But I would also say that this approach of getting people into their own home and then delivering the amount of support they need is the absolute kind of crucial sort of fundamental building block.
Housing first, in other words.
Yes, and we've sent a proposal, and very rarely been as pleased to send an email to government as this one. We sent a fully costed proposal through to the government in Westminster last week, detailing how much it would cost and all of the detailed measures needed to completely roll out Housing First and all of the support.
And how much would it cost in England?
Our estimate is £97 million over 12 months. And I think that that's a bargain to save the lives of and improve the lives of some of the most marginalised people we have in the country.
And maybe we should end on this. I mean, isn't it very striking, the sort of boldness of the action in the crisis when it was, you know, well, when government decided it was an emergency, but the incrementalism. I was just so struck by Matt by what you said about, you know, the government achieved its 5-day target in 2 days, or, you know, the 5-day target became a 2-day target, 5-year target, sorry, became a two-day target. I mean, what does this teach us, do you both think?
I mean, I think there's a strong argument that we spend a lot of money in homelessness, but not always in the most effective or evidence-based ways. What we already know about Housing First, and it's why people feel so passionately about it, is that first of all, it's just a very non-patronising way of redressing the disadvantage that people have often spent a lifetime experiencing by making no assumptions about them or what they need, and just recognising that most of us, with the right support, can manage our own place. I mean, that's it. But what also Housing First, we know about it, is that it costs less than status quo. So it costs less to house people than it does to keep them homeless. And it's such an important message to keep, I think, at the front of all our minds as we go forward, is that getting people off the streets and enabling people to build and live their lives is more cost effective for local and national governments and housing associations and others, as well as obviously being better for people that it affects.
Matt?
Yeah, I think that to add to that, one of the things that we've learned through the last few weeks that we probably knew anyway is that the experiment with localism and homelessness has failed. That the idea that you have a fragmented system where, you know, hundreds of different approaches can take place across the country, some people having the resources, some people not, some people, you know, having, you know, rules for some people that would qualify one side of a border and not on the other for housing. That's just inappropriate. And I don't think you need to be a Stalinist to say that a kind of statist approach to this achieves more than leaving it to be devolved to every council to think about it in their own way. And you know, it became unacceptable overnight for the government to imagine that there would be people dying of a deadly virus on our streets. But people die on our streets anyway. 700 people a year die in England and Wales whilst they're homeless. And that should have already been unacceptable. It's fantastic that we've seen this move forward, but it is very, in many ways, very sad for those people who didn't see that level of urgency when they needed it in their life beforehand.
And if somebody going out for their once a day exercise meets somebody who's still homeless despite all of these measures, where should they direct them?
Well, if you're in England or Wales, then there's a service called StreetLink, which is an app you can download on your phone, or a number that you can call, which essentially just refers the person to the local council, and the outreach team's meant to come and find them and offer accommodation. Obviously, Maggie can talk for Scotland, but that's a system that is there right across England and Wales. So hopefully everyone can use that.
Maggie?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that we always hear from people that have slept rough is never underestimate the power and welcome of somebody just saying hello and asking, you know, how you are. That's incredibly important for people not to feel invisible, and particularly right now. I think beyond that, what's almost certainly the case is that people are already connected to services. So in Scotland, there's great outreach support workers, particularly across those two cities, Simon Community, Cyrenians, Bethany, and others who know who's still out there and who are connected into them. So what's preventing people coming inside is a whole complicated set of issues beyond that you know, immediate need for housing.
Okay. Well, look, Maggie Brunges, Matt Downey, genuinely, this has been a reason to be cheerful conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
We're going to speak now to Danny Dorling, who is a professor of geography at the University of Oxford. Danny, hello. Thanks for Zooming with us. We've got a nice view of an acoustic guitar over your right shoulder there.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
We want Danny's wife to play it, but we haven't yet persuaded him. She's the guitar player, is that right?
Yes, if you have me on again, we can try and do that. Might be a bit shy about it, but we will ask.
And how are you coping with lockdown, Danny?
Better now than I was. We kind of adapt, human beings. It's amazing how quickly you get used to something.
What did you struggle with at first?
I was absolutely addicted to my normal life. All the things that we complain about, like going into work or the commute, you suddenly realise how much you missed them. And I was really addicted to, you know, I give talks about books, I travel around the country. To my great shame, I've been shocked how many flights I have had to cancel. And I didn't realise how often I flew. And it took some time. This is the positive side. That, you know, the negative side of thing is not seeing the people you work with, still working with them or seeing them like this, and trying to hold meetings where you can't just give somebody a sideways glance, which smooths things over. You know, that's much trickier than now. And you know, the loneliness is not good. And watching the kids not be able to see their friends, that's pretty awful.
Well, I wanted to start by asking you just what you make of the rapid action on rough sleeping that we've seen in the last few weeks. And like, does that really demonstrate that homelessness was never inevitable?
Homelessness certainly wasn't inevitable, but the demonstration of that is other countries in Europe. The only country, I think, which had a rate similar to ours was Germany. And that was because of the so many Syrian refugees, of which a very small proportion were homeless. And, of course, everybody knows about Finland and how few people are homeless in Finland. the sort of sad thing about the rounding up of the homeless with this pandemic was it wasn't done because government cared about the homeless. It was done out of absolute fear that homeless people will spread this disease to people like them and their families. We should admit that. There's a remarkable similarity between the reaction to this disease and the way that the middle and upper classes reacted to cholera when that came into London in the 1840s. Back then, and we now know in hindsight, the risk to the upper and middle classes from cholera was much less than they thought. But they absolutely panicked, and it's good because they financed sewer systems and so on. But I am afraid that the reaction for the homeless was not about caring about the homeless. It was the idea that this disease will spread amongst the homeless, which of course was ridiculous, epidemiologically ridiculous. This is not how the disease spreads. The disease spreads amongst people like me who move around the country. The disease came in of people who were quite well off, people who'd been on a skiing holiday. The last people who spread this disease were homeless people.
Do you think, though, you know, whatever the intentions were, we will now see homelessness being treated as a public health issue, which I know is something you've done a lot of work on in the past?
We should. We're going to have to fight and work at it. There's a small danger, small, I hope, because I believe we're so much better than this. But there's a small danger of actually losing the lessons of these few weeks. The major public health issue of homeless wasn't necessarily a street homelessness, although people were dying with an average life expectancy in their 40s. It was the thousands, tens of thousands, and in a sense millions of people whose mental health was damaged by the precarious situation that they're living in, knowing that there's a chance you could be homeless. 250,000 young Londoners under 25 sofa surfing. Now, they had a sofa to sleep on, but the effect on you of not knowing, not having a home, not knowing where you're going to be, and thinking you could be that person sleeping in the gutter and nobody would give a damn. Yeah, that was what we had as a situation. That is what we've got to get out of. But one other thing crucially important to say about homelessness, we right now have families locked into rooms in B&Bs in a situation in London which is absolutely untenable, where it was bad enough being in a B&B and all sleeping one room before this. But the inability to go out and socialise now, it's a form of prison. We have not requisitioned the empty properties in London and move those families with children out of a single room into some of those properties. And if we really cared, if we'd really cared, and given the emergency, we could have done that, and we chose not to.
What do you think that the unprecedented steps taken by the government during this crisis show about the sort of ability to solve injustice and inequality? Because for a, you know, you've written about myths such as exclusion being necessary and despair being inevitable. I mean, one good thing, presumably, about this crisis is it shatters that on this issue.
Yes. Oh, a whole set of things have been shattered. And the current government are learning a lot of things about life. You know, things that never occurred within their lifetimes and things that they hadn't imagined. So our current government believed very much in a certain way of doing things. And they thought, to put it very simply, the market is best, leave it to the market, the better it'll be, the more you reduce the state, the better. To suddenly have to go from that to cancelling the debts of the NHS, to turning the tap on, to realising that there is more important things than your weird belief in the power of the market, has been very educational, particularly for this government. And there are, of course, there are other times in history in Britain, particularly wartime, when a similar thing occurs. You can become used to enormous injustices and think it's okay. That's what they had become used to. You can be used to mass poverty and kind of rationalise it. You can't become used to millions of people suddenly looking at destitution and you are the government, and it's none of their fault whatsoever. So I think it's a really interesting moment for learning and deciding what you value. I just have this fear that it'll be treated as a one-off, and as the numbers of deaths reduce, as the lockdown is released in the next few weeks, there'll be an attempt by people who were very comfortable with the way that Britain was last year. There'll be an attempt by some of them to get us back to that as soon as possible.
And how do we, in your view, avoid, when this is over, going back to the way we were? What do you think is key to that?
One thing is realizing that that is what we did every other time. So to go back, I'll miss out TB and I miss out AIDS because it's a long, slow pandemic. The last one like this was 1968. My father can remember not being able to get out of bed for 5 days. It was so bad, the flu of 68.
This is a flu, yeah.
A million people around the world, probably killed, almost certainly will kill more people in Britain than this will kill. And we were a younger population then. And then there was one in 57 and one in 51, which we have no memory of. And we don't talk much about 1918-19. So we must first of all remember the standard model for a pandemic is that we do forget. However, things were slowing down this time. We were heading to a global recession anyway. A teenage girl from Sweden had captivated the world and people were worried about the state of things. And that's very different from the feelings that people had in the 60s and 50s, where we were charging forward. So I'm hopeful that because we didn't think that the world was necessarily going in a particularly good direction, we were heading for a recession, we had trade wars, we had environmental catastrophe. Hopefully we won't forget the lessons of this in the way that we did actually for past pandemics in the last century.
Can we talk about that slowdown? You have a new book which is called Slowdown. You argue that, as you say that, the world was slowing down, population growth, economic growth, tech innovation and so on, even before this lockdown. Can you tell us a little bit about the theme of the book?
The book, it's ironic, it took me 6 years to write it. Finished the last corrections to it in January. It contains things about pandemics and epidemics and so on. But it's essentially a stepping back book that says if you step back and look at things like GDP growth, you can see that it was actually lower in the 60s and the 50s, lower in the 70s and the 60s, lower in the 80s and the 70s. We always tend to find particular events like the oil shock or the recession of the 80s and blame the lack of growth on those particular events. But actually growth was slowing anyway, and many things, well, I meant to write a book about the half of things that were rising and accelerating and the half that were falling. But when I carried on measuring things, I couldn't find almost anything accelerating. Only 4 or 5 things out of 1,000 that I looked at. And the things that were accelerating was our carbon pollution, the temperature of the planet, not just going up, but going up faster, the number of flights being taken worldwide, and the number of international university graduates. Now, this makes sort of sense generally. You shouldn't think that everything should always accelerate. But what I came to conclude when I looked at the rates of change in the past compared to now is that now we were actually slowing down at an unusual rate in the last 6 generations.
Why is that, Danny?
The guess is that we've been through something. I mean, this is, you know, I'm an academic. It sounds sort of silly knowing, but we've been through an enormous transformation. The easiest way is to talk about population. Population from 1800 to now doubled and doubled again, from 1 billion to almost 8 billion. Never in the history of the species have we had anything like that. We thought it was normal. We've become used to this thing. But this thing was a transformation, not a steady state. This thing that we've lived through, and us, our parents, grandparents, their parents and grandparents, is an aberration. Life for a species doesn't normally change that fast. If you go back 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 generations, your relatives then were living lives very like their parents, often in the village, often boring as far as we'd be concerned. Our children are now heading to doing things that are similar to us. So there's a slowdown. But it's based on empirics. This is not based on some great theory and reading. Yeah, there are so many academics who write very good theories. This is simply saying, step back and look at the numbers. And particularly in the last 10 or 20 years, the numbers have really changed. It's all good news for a more sustainable planet. But so much of our model of how we do things assumes a rate of growth which is no longer there, that we're going to have to think differently. And this was without this pandemic. This was on the cards anyway.
So on that, what are the implications of this slowdown as we look at how we recover from the current crisis?
It is that we have to adjust to seeing slowdown for the benefits it has. We have to get away from the idea that we have, because we're used to acceleration, of seeing acceleration and growth as good. We should expect future lives to be more similar to now. And we should expect innovation to come in ways which are not about greater consumption. So in particular, in the book, I've looked at Japan and how Japan has innovated a huge amount socially in the last couple of decades, what were called the lost decades. They're only lost economically. They're not actually lost in terms of changes to Japanese society. So there are all kinds of implications. But the main implication is that we shouldn't expect things to change as much as they changed for our parents and grandparents. They went through incredible change. And the danger for us mentally is that we think that's normal because it was normal for them. But we shouldn't expect to go through that change. And it's easy nowadays to say we should expect there to be less flying in future. But yeah, it didn't make sense to carry on accelerating the number of flights in the world as it was before. Anyway, slowdown becomes somewhat easier, hopefully, now.
Well, look, Danny Dorling, a very stimulating conversation. Your new book is Slow Down, Professor of Geography at University of Oxford. Thank you so much for joining us. And next time, your wife is going to be on playing the guitar.
She will. Thank you ever so much.
What did you think?
Well, this isn't the first time this has come up in recent weeks, is it? But when there's a need to do something, it can be done. I mean, that's the thing. We talked about this idea a couple of years ago. We used the example of Finland, where they'd use this housing first idea of just solving homelessness by first off giving people a place to live. And it seemed, you know, like something we could only dream of here. And of course, you wouldn't wish the circumstances in which this has happened on the country. But yeah, that's really made an impression on me, that a five-year plan was enacted in 2 days.
It is absolutely remarkable that a government target, which was a five-year target, became a two-day target. I mean, it only ever goes, at least in my experience, the other way. You know, two-day targets become five-year targets. You know, it just shows what is doable if you've got, as you say, as if you've got the will. And now, of course, the question is how do you stop it, you know, sliding back? But you know, you've got to ask, well, why would anyone want to go back to the way things were before? You know, and I was actually thinking about it, you know, I mean, there should really be sort of, it really should be the case that, you know, people shouldn't be, you know, people really shouldn't be turfed out of where they are until they have somewhere else to go. Because now that we've made this progress, you know, it's just got to be, it's, you know, we can't lose it. That's sort of what I feel.
And you've got a much clearer idea, I think, than I have of what these numbers mean in the scale of things, of government spending. But that figure of, I think, around £90 million, it seems like nothing in that context.
Well, exactly. It's certainly in the context of, you know, the costs facing government at the moment. And actually, what's even more remarkable is how little the, you know, that's to really, you know, almost, I think, according to Matt, solve the problem. But you know, look how little it seems to have cost to get to where we are. You know, it just shows. Well, to be honest, it shows you've got to be more bold and less timid and more ambitious.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
If you've got thoughts about what you've heard on today's podcast or future ideas, uplifting if possible, then please do get in touch at cheerfulpodcast.com. Chloe tweeted at us and she said, I injured myself in January and yesterday I ran my first non-stop 30-minute run since while listening to Ed Miliband glowing about Parkrun on Cheerful Podcast, and I just felt so full of joy. I've really missed running. I can't wait to go back to Parkrun UK when it returns. Chloe was talking about our interview with Paul Sinton-Hewitt, the amazing founder of Parkrun. Thank you so much for being in touch, Chloe. I am also looking forward to Parkrun restarting. I confess I have not been running really during this crisis, and so I suspect I'll be even slower than I was before.
I saw somebody tweeting a link to a TED talk on how to get the runner's high, which is something that has always eluded me.
Without running?
Yeah, well, it didn't say without running. I think it said with running.
Oh, right.
Because usually I don't get any kind of high from running, just a, you know, a stitch. But maybe it's because I've got flat feet. But I'm going to.
I do want those trainers. I do want those. You remember those Nike trainers?
The ones that give you the slight advantage.
The ones like pogo sticks. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
This tweet comes from Ayla Ishkander. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. Of all the names that Ed Miliband would call his imaginary dog, Chutney definitely doesn't come to mind. I imagined Harold. I particularly enjoyed the idea of Ed running after Harold, screaming his name in Richmond Park with herds of deer legging it.
Like Steptoe and Son, like Harold.
Ah, interesting. Yeah. I thought of Harold Lloyd.
Oh, I thought Harold Wilson.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, we all project a different Harold onto you, Ed.
Gordon, I could have called it.
This email arrived from Sarah Collins, who says, "This isn't a complaint, but I can hear random key noises, email notifications, and swirling sounds.
Guilty.
Not all the time, but every now and then."
Guilty. Guilty as charged.
"We are at a stage now where we have to start recording the podcast 15 minutes early, just while Ed switches off his various devices, asks his two sons to give him a wide berth, settles Chutney down with a bowl of imaginary
now,
food."
I am very conscious that at least when I came round to your house and I was late, you got to just, like, stay in your house. I suppose you get to stay in your house now, but it's sort of, at least you could kind of aim off my time of arrival.
Well, any random noises are probably coming from your end then. And we've had quite a few tweets and email messages like this one. This came from Jack Ashton, who says, "Slightly gutted that Channel 4's Reasons to be Cheerful Tonight isn't cheerful podcast. I really thought for a moment that I was going to get half an hour of Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd on the TV." Yes, this is this new Matt Lucas show.
And is it actually called Reasons to be Cheerful?
It is. I believe it's written by Harry Hill or created by Harry Hill, and Matt Lucas is hosting it. I haven't watched it.
I mean, we haven't talked about this in detail, but I mean, I know Ian Jury deserves the original credit, right, for this. But I do think, and this is your credit, not mine, because it was you who came up with the thing. I do think, and I know because the trouble is there's no way to trace this, although it might be worth doing a sort of Google, you know, doodle thing, you know, of sort of looking back at how much the phrase, maybe Joel could do this, how much the phrase was being used, like, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and like then 2 years ago, and 1 year ago, and now. Because I do think we've had a like marginal impact on the zeitgeist on this, don't you think?
I think so. So obviously there's the song, and then I think people had sort of periodically used it as a title for books or stage shows or whatever. But I think, you know, the podcast has brought it back into the public consciousness. You saw it as headlines for features and stuff in the couple of years after we launched.
Do you think we should do some sort of, you know, academic research?
Yes, I think that would be a good way to spend our time in lockdown.
Email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
Righty-tighty, we're in the outro.
And I believe we have some real-time results of the Reasons to be Cheerful Google metrics that Joel was just looking into.
The tension is unbearable.
So I have a graph in front of me. It starts in 2004, goes up to the present day, and it shows spikes where searches for Reasons to be Cheerful as a search term have increased. And I can tell you, we started the podcast in September of 2017, and the biggest spike looks like it was about 2006. There was quite a big spike in 2004 as well.
I think you're doing us down here. That's probably some Ian Jury re-release. But you know, actually, there's definitely an upswing after April 28. Well, it looks like sort of late 2018, 2019, don't you think?
Yeah. I think we've got a little spike there where we launched the podcast as well.
A spikeette.
It's not so much a little mountain, it's more of a hillock, but even so.
We've got a claim, haven't we?
Yes. Well, maybe we can get another little spike for Reason to Be Cheerful by inviting people to go to our website where you can sign up for our newsletter.
Smooth.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You can sign up for our newsletter, but also there's lots of in-depth stuff on previous episodes of the podcast if you fancy reading up and delving into the various bits of research that we've done. Then go and knock yourself out. Just search Reasons to Be Cheerful on Google, or you could just go to cheerfulpodcast.com. Just trying to get those search spikes up.
So I think you're off to do some pressure hosing.
I'm off to watch my wife pressure hose.
Yep. That's a kind of good use of lockdown. I'd like to thank Matt Downey, Maggie Brunges, and Danny Dorling.
And Emma Caution produces our podcast with research and backup from Joel Pearce and Joe Kenyon. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made the idents. Ed Seed composed the music. And the artwork was designed by
Henry Cole.
He's been Ed Miliband.
He's been Jeff Lloyd.
And these have been
Reasons to Be Cheerful.